competition for control over strategic resources and shipping routes.
Analysts believe that the U.S. and other NATO military alliance member states have adopted a dual-track policy. While claiming to assist the central administration in Mogadishu, these imperialist powers are also strengthening the breakaway region of Somaliland. A weak and balkanized Somalia is in the interests of imperialist powers bent on controlling the strategic Horn of Africa region.
On the 17th of April, a group of major European powers and the U.S. issued a statement about their talks with Somaliland secessionists waging war against Somali nationalists. Now, do you think this meeting is reinforcing the West's de facto recognition of the breakaway region of Somaliland and encouraging the balkanization of Somalia?
Look, it is worth noting that the situation in Somalia is complex, you know, and that, look, there are multiple actors with competing interests and agenda. The conflict in the Sul, Sanan, Kane regions is just one of the many challenges facing the country, which is also grappling with issues such as terrorism, poverty, and political instability. You know, so while the international partners have an important, you know, role to play, you know, in promoting peace and stability in Somalia, the ultimate responsibility for resolving the country's problems actually, you know, lies with the Somali people themselves.
Somalia Coast is of geostrategic importance due to its location along the Gulf of Aden, the Arabian Sea, and the Indian Ocean. Now, this country may have the richest untapped oil and uranium reserves in the world. Now, is this the reason foreign powers are meddling in the country to ultimately loot its resources?
Most likely, you know, any country, especially that's the story of Africa, you know, where, you know, there are huge reserves. Look, we take the DRC, there's a problem with the DRC, which, you know, most of us believe, you know, is the work of external forces, just to divide the people, create disunity for them to exploit, you know, the resources in the country. So the same, you know, could apply to Somaliland.
The people of Somalia speak one language, share one culture, and practice one religion. And the people in this country desire peace and stability, as these Somalia activists point out here.
We're here today as Somalis to manifest our desire to unite our country, to end the 30 years of division between Somalia and Somaliland. It is the beginning of the end of Somali division at this time, and we're hoping that this, without shedding too much blood,
Now, if the people of Somalia unite and realize their shared common destiny, outside actors will find it difficult to continue business as usual. Why has peace and unity been so elusive in this strategic Horn of Africa state?
You see, Somalia has a complex history of political, you know, and social instability, and that has hindered efforts towards peace and unity. And one major factor has been the legacy of colonialism, you know, which divided the Somali people into five different territories and left them with little experience in self-governance. You know, I mean, when Somalia gained independence in 1960, it was a unified state, but the new government struggled, you know, to establish a stable democracy and faced ongoing conflicts, you know, with neighboring countries. You know, the 1969 coup led by General Siad Barre overthrew the civilian government.
Well, there you have it. Somalia is still suffering from the legacy of colonialism, and these imperialist powers are still pursuing the balkanization of this country. I would like to thank guest today, Jonathan Ofe, and Sir, the publisher of Africa Briefing, for his incisive analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on how the U.S. is destabilizing African countries by training military coup leaders on the continent. Stay with us.
U.S. military trained coup leaders in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Over the last 3 years, African countries, especially in West Africa, have been in the grip of a wave of coups, popular protests, and fierce geopolitical struggles. Now, the declining Western hegemony has seen intensified competition for access and control of Africa's natural resources.
As the African Union struggles to stop military coups in the continent, the United States has confirmed that it trained several military officers involved in military takeovers in Africa. General Michael Langley, the commander of the U.S. Military Command in Africa, has admitted that the U.S. has trained coup leaders in Africa.
He made the confession while answering questions from Republican Matt Gaetz during the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on the U.S. Central Command and the U.S. Africa Command. Let's take a listen.
And what percentage of the people we've trained end up participating in insurrections or coups against their own government?
Very small number, Congressman. Very small number.
So what percentage do you think?
I'd say probably less than 1%.
But it does happen.
The IMET program is in force, and we've pushed a significant number through our schools across the
military. And what data sets do you track to arrive at the conclusion that less than 1% of the roughly 50,000 that we've trained have participated in coups? Because it'd be like about 500, about 1% of 50,000.
Congressman, you may have that information. I don't at this time, but I know.
Well, for more on how U.S. military incites military takeovers in Africa, we have contacted Gerald Horn, a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston. Now, we have seen the head of U.S. African Military Command there admitting that the U.S. military trained some coup leaders in Africa. What's your take on this?
That in order to understand the U.S. role in Africa today, you have to understand the U.S. relationship with France, which is a major neo-colonial power in Africa. The bargain was that as long as France could keep a lid on its neo-colonial empire in Africa, then the United States would not object to that empire. But of late, France has had a seeming inability to do so. France has been kicked out of Mali. They're in bad odor in Mali. They have been marginalized in the Central African Republic, and that nation has invited the Wagner Group of Russia to be part of the security apparatus in Bangui, the capital. And this has caused the United States to reconsider its agreement with France. You see that the United States is becoming more active in Africa, and that leads us directly to the comment by Mr. Langley suggesting that the United States trains military leaders and officers.
For decades, coups occurred mainly during moments of perceived chaos with the aim to disrupt the normal constitutional dispensation in order to restore order. However, many resource-rich countries that experience coups have fallen into a permanent state of crisis. Pan-African activist PLO Lumumba believes the most military coups and takeovers in Africa are backed by Western powers.
And when you look at some of these removals and or elimination, they were carefully choreographed. When the leaders were careful to ensure that they were moving to liberate their people, it is now common knowledge that Western agencies orchestrated their removal from office. They invaded our barracks, and at one time it was being said of many African countries that coups were as frequent as breakfast.
Some experts assert that the U.S. is deliberately fomenting instability in Africa in pursuit of its colonial objectives. What's your take on this opinion?
The United States cannot compete with China effectively in Africa. China has built a railway from Nairobi, Kenya, to the Indian Ocean coast port city of Mombasa. China has built a railway from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, Ethiopia being the largest, second largest nation by population in Africa, the railway reaching to Djibouti on the coast of Africa. There's talk about China building spurs from Nairobi and Addis Ababa west into Sudan. And China has also built the headquarters of the African Union in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. When Vice President Harris of the United States visited Africa just a few weeks ago, she landed in Accra, Ghana, Lusaka, Zambia, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. The airports that she landed in were all partially or wholly funded and or designed by Chinese interests. The United States cannot compete with China on that level, and so it's decided to become a chaos agent in Africa, that is to say, to try to rule through military and military coups. And that is the sum and substance of U.S. policy in Africa today.
AFRICOM, the U.S. military command in Africa, has undermined African militaries and compelled the continent to enter into Washington's so-called war on terror. However, terrorism has been on the rise in the continent. So Africa is really not benefiting from the presence of the U.S. military in Africa. Isn't it about time that the U.S. military vacates Africa?
It is well past time for the United States military to evacuate Africa because it plays no useful role. It threatens stability in Africa. And when you threaten stability in Africa, you threaten stability in West Asia, what is oftentimes referred to as the Middle East. You threaten stability not only in Egypt, but in the areas east of Egypt, speaking of Syria, for example, where the United States has been interfering in that nation's internal affairs for a number of years now. We all know about U.S. interference in the internal affairs of Iraq, beginning with the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. So yes, obviously, the U.S. military needs to withdraw from Africa.
The authorities in Mali decided to establish closer relations with Russia in a bid to restore stability in the country. This move angered Western powers in the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov confirmed that Mali requested the assistance of a Russian military contractor to combat terrorism in the country.
They are combating terrorism, incidentally, and they've turned to a private military company from Russia in connection with the fact that, as I understand, France wants to significantly draw down its military component, which was present there, and as everyone understood, should have been combating terrorists who established a presence in Kidal, but they didn't manage to do that.
Analysts believe the real reason for increased U.S. military presence in Africa is seen as countering China and Russia.
This is particularly the case in light of Ukraine, where the United States was shocked and surprised by the reality that many African nations have not supported the sanctions crusade against Russia. This has caused many in Washington to feel that the United States needs to deepen its claws into the flesh of Africa. Likewise, as noted, the United States cannot compete effectively with China on the socioeconomic level in Africa. And therefore, the only card the United States feels it can play is the military card, hence Africa.
One way of preventing U.S. and Western military domination in Africa is to have strong African armies securing the continent. Now, what's the reason for failure in building strong armies capable of defending the continent from both internal and external threats?
Well, first of all, Africa is likely the poorest continent, not least because of the devastation caused by European nations like Britain, France, Portugal, for example, not to mention the United States of America, in the depopulation of Africa by dint of the African slave trade. I am a product of the African slave trade. My ancestors were kidnapped in Africa decades ago, centuries ago, and dragged across the Atlantic to work for free in the United States, helping to build this so-called superpower. Because of the devastation of Africa, many of the economies have yet to recover, not to mention the fact that those nations that have sought to fight back, you see that their leaders are killed. For example, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo in 1961. Keep in mind that the Democratic Republic of Congo has a territory larger than all of Western Europe. Think of Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso in the 1980s. Think of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in 2011. So whenever you see an African nation seeking to stand up, you see that the United States and its allies and NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, decide that that is not acceptable, and they move against said nation militarily.
Well, there you have it. The U.S.-led NATO military alliance does not want to see a united and stable Africa. I would like to thank our guest, Gerald Horn, who is a professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the U.S., First Republic Bank customers withdrew more than $100 billion from their accounts in the first 3 months of the year amid concerns about the health of the global banking system. The U.S. bank, First Republic, says its deposits fell by over 40% since the end of December. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Thank you. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Customers of First Republic Bank pulled more than $100 billion in deposits out of the bank during the last month's crisis, as fears swelled that it could be the third bank to fail after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. San Francisco-based First Republic said on Monday, 24th of April, that it was only after a group of large banks stepped in to save it by depositing $30 billion in uninsured deposits that the bank was able to staunch the bleeding. After gaining 12% on Monday, 24th of April, the bank's shares tumbled more than 20% after the close of trading. First Republic stock has tumbled 90% this year amid investor concerns about the stability of regional lenders in the United States after a March collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The story of deposit outflows steadily continues, unlike the company saying that by 27th of March, their deposits had stabilized. Ben Emons, senior portfolio manager and head of fixed income at New Edge Wealth, said in an email. First Republic said it now plans to sell off assets and restructure its balance sheet, and said it also expects to lay off as much as a quarter of its workforce, which totaled about 7,200 employees at the end of 2022. First Republic Bank reported first quarter results on Monday, 24th of April, that showed it had $173.5 billion in deposits in early March before Silicon Valley Bank failed on 9th of March. On 21st of April, it had deposits of $102.7 billion, including the $30 billion the big banks deposited. It said since late March, its deposits have been relatively stable. "We continue to take steps to strengthen our business," Jim Herbert, the bank's executive chairman, and Mike Roffler, the bank's chief executive officer, said in a joint statement. Before the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic had a banking franchise that was the envy of most of the industry. Its clients, mostly the rich and powerful, rarely defaulted on their loans. The bank made much of its money making low-cost loans to the rich, which reportedly included Meta Platform CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Even through this crisis, the bank's book of loans more than 90 days past due was zero. But its franchise became a liability when bank customers and analysts started focusing on the fact that the vast majority of First Republic's deposits, like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, were uninsured. That is, above the $250,000 limit set by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which means that if First Republic were to fail, its depositors may not get all of their money back. The bank's profits fell 33% from a year earlier, according to its earnings, and revenues were down by 13%. Wall Street analyst Adam Crisafulli of Vital Knowledge said in a report for investors that First Republic's earnings prospects are still pretty bleak. The Associated Press news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Depositors at First Republic Bank pulled more than $100 billion out of the bank during last month's crisis, as fears swelled that it could be the third bank to fail after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The San Francisco-based First Republic said on Monday, 24th of April, that it was only able to staunch the bleeding after a group of large banks stepped in to save it by depositing $30 billion in uninsured deposits. It said it now plans to sell off assets and restructure its balance sheet and lay off as much as a quarter of its workforce, which totaled about 7,200 employees at the end of last year. Its stock tumbled more than 20% in after-hours trading on Monday, 24th of April. First Republic reported first quarter results on Monday showed that it had $173.5 billion in deposits before Silicon Valley Bank failed on 9th of March this year. On 21st of April, it had deposits of $102.7 billion, including the $30 billion the big banks deposited. It said since late March, its deposits have been relatively stable. We continue to take steps to strengthen our business, Jim Herbert, the bank's executive chairman, and Mike Roffler, the bank's chief executive officer, said in a joint statement. Bank executives did not take questions from industry analysts during a call on Monday about the quarterly results. Before the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic had a banking franchise that was the envy of most of the industry. Its clients, mostly rich and powerful individuals, rarely defaulted on their loans. The bank made much of its money making low-cost loans to the rich. Even though the crisis triggered by the collapse of the two banks, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, First Republic's book of loans more than 90 days past due was zero. But its franchise became a liability when bank customers and analysts noted that the vast majority of First Republic's deposits, like those in Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, were uninsured. That is, above the $250,000 limit set by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which meant that if First Republic Bank were to fail, its depositors would not be able to get all of their money back. BBC has also covered this story. First Republic Bank customers withdrew more than $100 billion from their accounts in the first 3 months of the year amid concerns about the health of the global banking system. The U.S. bank First Republic says its deposits fell by over 40% since the end of December. It comes after Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse yesterday revealed the scale of the bank run that triggered its state-backed rescue last month. A series of bank collapses have raised fears of a crisis in the banking sector. With the closure of several banks in March, we experienced unprecedented deposit outflows, First Republic's chief financial officer, Neil Holland, said. Neil Holland added, "We're working to restructure our balance sheet and reduce our expenses and short-term borrowings." First Republic also said it planned to cut costs by shedding 20% to 25% of its workforce in the coming months. Shares in the bank fell by more than 20% in extended trading in New York after it made the announcement. Last month, a group of major U.S. banks injected $30 billion into the First Republic, which had been seen as at risk of failure. U.S. regulators called the move most welcome, while the banks, led by J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, said the action reflected their confidence in the First Republic. Problems in the banking sector surfaced in the United States earlier last month when Silicon Valley Bank, which was the country's 16th largest bank, collapsed in the biggest failure of a U.S. bank since 2008. That was quickly followed just 2 days later by the failure of New York bank Signature Bank.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV. In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. Protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before of what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered armed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely, we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. We don't have the only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. What the footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them. Have them go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically, one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening with a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
Gardner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Gardner case.
Thank you.
recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
Police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
The British leader met with his Dutch counterpart to discuss ways to aid Kiev in its conflict with Russia. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has committed to establishing an international coalition that would supply Western fighter jets to Ukraine as part of an effort to enhance the country's combat air capabilities in collaboration with allies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said he will work to create an international coalition to provide Western fighter jets to Ukraine, pledging to bolster the country's combat air capabilities alongside allies. In a statement following a meeting with Dutch PM Mark Rutte at the Council of Europe summit recently, Sunak's office said the two leaders would take steps to help coordinate aircraft shipments to Kiev. Sunak and Prime Minister Rutte agreed they would work to build an international coalition to provide Ukraine with combat air capabilities, supporting it with everything from training to procuring F-16 jets. 10 Downing Street said, stressing the importance of allies providing long-term security assistance to Ukraine. The Prime Minister did not specify what country might offer the American-made fighter jet, which is operated by more than 2 dozen nations, but suggested he would press allies to help facilitate the weapons transfers. Ukrainian officials have requested the aircraft for months with a senior defense ministry aide telling Politico that Kiev hopes to receive up to 50 F-16s from Washington and other partners. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with Sunak in an unannounced visit to the UK recently, where he called for a new coalition of jets, an idea well received by the British PM. The concept has been proposed by Kiev and other allies before, with Poland also voicing interest in such a project after providing some of its own Soviet-era MiG-29 fighters. Despite the renewed discussion of a jet coalition, some Western powers appear reluctant to supply advanced warplanes. Though Ukrainian pilots are already being trained to operate the F-16 by the U.S. military, and will soon receive similar instruction from British pilots, American, German, and French officials have indicated they would not be willing to supply jets from their own arsenals. However, Washington has previously reversed course after declining to provide certain weapon systems, including the Patriot missile defense platform and the M1 Abrams main battle tank, both of which have since been pledged to Ukraine. Berlin, too, backtracked after refusing to transfer its Leopard 2 tank, agreeing to send the weapon earlier this year following pressure from allies. Russia has repeatedly warned that deliveries of more sophisticated weapons to Ukraine could cross its red lines and lead to a major escalation. According to Moscow, the arms, intelligence, and training provided to Kiev's troops have already